Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS, Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning on Spirit Mornings. I'm Bruce McGregor with
Chris McGregor.
And Chris, as always, a pleasure to have back with us Mike Aquilina. Mike, the Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Also the author of more than a dozen books on Catholic history, doctrine, and devotion. Maintains a website on the early church fathers that is a recommended daily visit, fathersofthechurch.com. He and his wonderful wife, Terry, live with their six children near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Mike, as always, a true delight to have you with us on the program.
Oh, it's always a delight to be here.
I am very excited about today because we're going to take on a subject that occasionally I just have to scratch my head about, the lives of three men in particular that are considered fathers of the church, but they're not saints.
Well, that's true. And some people argue that they're not fathers of the church because they're not saints. It's been a disputed question down through the ages because there's no canonized list of the fathers of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, we say, you know, that the fathers are those who are traditionally called fathers. So it's somewhat self-referential. But the you know, there are certain criteria that churchmen and theologians use when they're considering who's a father and who's not. And number one is holiness of life.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is soundness of doctrine. Three is church approval, and four is antiquity. So we look at those four criteria, and some of the men who are the major Christian writers from the early centuries did not fulfill all four of them 100%, let's
say. Right.
You know, there were some shadows in their biographies, and as a result, some theologians and some churchmen have been reluctant to call them fathers, but refer to them instead as ecclesiastical writers.
Wow.
We identify them as Christians. They're
mm-hmm.
in the church, but they're not quite fathers. Now, others say that they should be recognized as fathers because especially the three who are most controversial are very important to Christian history. And it seems that the trend in the last 50 years or so is to consider these three men fathers of the church.
They have been widely quoted and referenced to by as recently as John Paul and Pope Benedict the 16th. They
That's
refer
right.
to them their teachings quite a bit.
That's right. We're talking here about Tertullian,
mm-hmm.
who was a North African who wrote in the 100s and 200s. So we're talking about very early. We're talking about Origen, an Egyptian scholar who was writing a little bit later, but about the same time. He was born in the late 100s and he died in the mid 200s. And then we're talking about Eusebius, the great church historian, who was born in the mid 200s and died in the mid 300s. So we're talking about very important teachers of the early church.
Well, let's start with Tertullian, because he is somebody I really wasn't very aware of until you brought him to light for me in discussing Saint Perpetua.
Oh, yes.
And how he really chronicled her story and made her martyrdom and her sacrifice known to so many.
Well, Tertullian was a lawyer, and it's quite possible that he was the famous lawyer Tertullian, who was quoted often in the legal annals of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite possible, because he was a brilliant man and obviously esteemed by his contemporaries. He grew up in North Africa, in the city of Carthage. He probably didn't stray from home too much,
mm-hmm.
But he was a great scholar. He was obviously trained in philosophy and rhetoric, and he had a full and rich education. He converted to Christianity as an adult when it was a difficult time to be a Christian because of the persecutions in North Africa. North Africa was always a kind of hotbed of persecution. When they flared up there, they really flared up.
Mm.
But he became a great defender of the faith. Some of his earliest works, he started writing about 197 A.D.,
mm-hmm.
and some of his earliest works were addressed to the pagans, to the nations, and they were apologetic works. That is, they sought to explain and defend what Christians really believed, because there were a lot of rumors about what went on behind the closed doors of Christian churches. That, you know, some people said that the Christians were were murdering babies behind closed doors, and the Christians were having cannibalistic feasts, or they were having orgies of drunkenness. And Tertullian really brought forth all of these things and debunked them one by one. And then he took the positive approach of explaining Christian doctrine to the pagans, and he did it very effectively.
Just like a lawyer.
Just like a lawyer, and a very good one. He's known for the persuasiveness of his arguments, the force of his arguments, but also his ability to turn a phrase or even coin a term. He was really the first great writer, great Christian writer in the Latin language. Most of the Christian writers up to this point, well, all of them that have survived, wrote in Greek. So he's the first one to use Latin, and he seems to have coined some of the terms that became ubiquitous afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
The terms like Trinity, for example, we find it for the first time there in Tertullian. He also gave us some phrases that are memorable, like the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Mm-hmm.
The song, "They'll know we are Christians by our love," that's all taken from Tertullian. All of those phrases that have become kind of the stock of Christian quotations.
I'm struck, Mike, by those witnesses of the persecution of the early church who were very passionate for the faith, maybe influenced by what they observed, that at certain times that passion led them to seek out a purer church, and it was difficult for them to reconcile sometimes the sin that can be found in that church.
That's right. That's right. And we find this in almost a parable in the life of Tertullian, because he was living in a time of intense persecution. He's the one who preserved for us, for example, Saint Perpetua's own story,
mm-hmm,
of her own imprisonment, and then the story of her own execution at the hands of the authorities. So he had a great devotion to the martyrs, and he saw their heroic witness on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there were other people who committed apostasy, who caved in under pressure and under torture. And there were still other Christians who gave in to other sins, serious sins, mortal sins like adultery and fornication. And he saw this going on around him, and he saw the contrast between the heroism of the martyrs and the laxity of certain Christians. And he said, these two things can't exist in the same church.
Mm-hmm.
And he was scandalized when the church showed mercy to repentant sinners and forgave their sins and readmitted them to the sacraments. Well, at this time, there arose a prophetic, a kind of pseudo-charismatic movement at the fringes of the church. It was really influenced by Phrygian religion, and it was called Montanism, after its founder, Montanus.
Mm-hmm.
And he was assisted by two prophetesses, these women who would utter oracular statements. Now, they were known for the severity of their lifestyle and their uncompromising, strict morality. And Tertullian decided that they were right and the Catholic Church was wrong, and he insisted that heroism in Christian life is a mandate and everyone must live by it or leave the Church. So he afterwards, and this happened rather late in his life, but afterwards he would contrast the Church of the Pure with the Church of a bunch of bishops, is what he called the Catholic Church, because he separated himself from communion by joining up with these heretics.
I think it really is an important lesson for so many when you feel you know the Church better than the Church itself. That makes it very hard, doesn't it?
It does, and not only that, but it leads you astray into some pretty weird places. It's kind of sad, and it should humble us as Christians that Tertullian, because of the behavior of certain Christians, he found this weird religion to be more attractive, and
mm-hmm,
simply because they seemed to be living the life of the Beatitudes better than many Christians were. So we should all do this, not by striving to condemn others the way Tertullian did, or run away the way Tertullian did, but to live better lives and more exemplary Christian lives so that the great men like Tertullian don't want to leave the church. It is a tragedy of epic proportions that Tertullian gave in to this impulse of rigorism and really fled the mercy of the church because he was such a great mind and such a great teacher that it's a shame that his teaching has to have this taint down through the ages. In the very next generation, in the very same city in which he lived, Saint Cyprian was the bishop. Mm-hmm. And Cyprian, Jerome tells us that Cyprian used to call for his books of Tertullian by saying, "Bring me the master." Mm. He considered Tertullian to be his great teacher, the great teacher of North Africa. And yet, whenever Cyprian quoted him in any of his works, he did not attribute the quotes. He wouldn't quote him by name. So he recognized the value of the teaching, but he also recognized the scandal of Tertullian's going into schism during his lifetime.
Yeah, there's so many lessons through his life that we can learn, and I think one of the strongest is that what marvels the Holy Spirit can work even through a broken earthen vessels.
That's right, and the marvels in Tertullian are the works that survived. What's amazing about him is that so much of his work has survived from such an early date in the church. So lovingly was it preserved by the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really a witness to that mercy that he condemned in his lifetime. The Catholic Church saw his work as so valuable that it preserved it down through the years, and it appears many times in magisterial documents. I've pointed out before that I think Tertullian is the only writer referred to as a father of the church in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Wow. In the Fathers of the Church, an introduction to the first Christian teachers, you bring out some of his works, including his great apology that he wrote.
That's right.
And how he was really trying to appeal to Roman governors to stop their severe persecution of the Christians.
That's right. And he knew their language. He knew how to speak their language, and he spoke it very persuasively. He was able to speak as a lawyer to others who were in the practice of governance. What's interesting about Tertullian is that he had the capacity to appeal to pagans on their own terms, but at the same time, he had this tendency to reject all things that were not explicitly Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So he could play both sides of the fence. He has this famous phrase, "What has Athens to do with Jerusalem?" Meaning, what has Greek culture, Greek philosophy, Greek art, what has all this to do with Jerusalem, Scripture, Revelation, Jesus Christ? The interesting thing is that while he was putting out these arguments against Athens, he was using rhetorical methods that were developed by Greek culture.
Mm-hmm.
He was using the forms of argument that the Greeks gave us. So he was able to take the best of that culture, really, and use it to purify the culture, to use it to excise the things that were not compatible with Christianity, although I don't know if it was clear in his mind that that's what he was doing. I think he saw it as more of a wholesale replacement of Greek culture with Christian culture.
He's such a paradox.
That's right, and he delighted in paradox too. He's the one who would often throw out the paradoxes of Christianity, that infinite God took on the finite form of a man, and he would make a litany of all these things, and he would just delight in the paradoxes of Christianity and invite people to mock him for it. He would say, "I believe because it is absurd."
Again, you point out one of the most quoted descriptions of the ancient church is attributed to him. "See those Christians, how they love one another."
That's right. He said that's what the pagans said about them, and I think we can believe that. That must have been the bait on the hook. That must have been the thing that made Christianity so attractive in the pagan culture, that the thing that the human heart wants more than anything else is love. Years later, another African, another native of the same area as Tertullian, St. Augustine, said that the deepest human desire is to look upon one who looks back in love. Well, that is it, and that is what attracted everyone to the Christian church, because they knew that that when they went into these congregations of sinners, these sinners would look upon them with love, even though they were sinners too. And it made it attractive. He details the works of love that took place: the feeding of the poor, the clothing of the naked, the sheltering of the homeless. All of these things that took place within the church. Mm-hmm. And again, this is what made Christianity so attractive to the Latin Roman culture of North Africa.
This is why he baffles me as this paradox, because somebody who can see that, write that, pass that down through antiquity, and yet in his own life could not give that nth degree of love to those that he celebrated the Eucharist with.
Well that's it, really. I mean, you're homing in on the big problem that all of us are prone to sin, and usually our greatest virtues could be the greatest temptation to sin. They could provide our occasions of giving in to excesses, and that's what he did. I mean, he allowed that passion to propel him right out of the church.
And when you have someone of his magnitude, Tertullian, his mind and his ability to be able to communicate the truth and to help his brothers and sisters, especially in those early years, generally he's not just one man that this has ever happened to. I mean, I think we can see examples of that even today.
Oh, sure. And down through history, you know, mm-hmm. find great minds like Abelard.
Yes.
I think the temptation is to pride, that when we find ourselves in this this position of teacher, of mm-hmm. someone who's revered by other Christians, we think that we're special, and we take delight in the fact that people are listening to us or reading us or talking about us, mm-hmm. and pretty soon we start to think of ourselves as the judges of the true teachers of the church. And in some cases, as in Tertullian's, he was probably the most gifted man in North Africa at the time, and he could compare his gifts to those of the bishops, maybe, and say, you know, I'm a better rhetorician than they are. I'm a better philosopher. I can state the case for the church more persuasively than they do. Mm-hmm. Well, what is their authority, and why isn't my authority greater? Why aren't they listening to me, Almighty me? Mm-hmm. You know, we're all prone to this kind of pride, and we've all got to be on the watch for it. That's the lesson that we have to take away from Tertullian's life.
And to be very wary of those who, I'll be real blunt, I mean, there are theologians out there that in their early writings were so profound and gave so much to the church, and yet in later years, they started echoing what Tertullian was saying. They start moving away from the bishops and the teaching tradition of the church, and they fall in love with the sound of their own voice.
That's right, and it happened. It happened in the 20th century. It's happening right now. You know? Mm-hmm. And it really does. It really should urge us to constancy in prayer, so that we always see ourselves in God's light. That we're not seeing ourselves in the public light, or in the light of our own distorted self-image. You know, what we wish ourselves to be, or what the image that we want to project of ourselves to the public. It's important for us to spend the time in prayer every day, and to see ourselves compared to God, because then, you know, that'll keep us humble. Prayer, we just can't overestimate. We need to have a sustained and disciplined life of prayer, mm-hmm. and we need to subject ourselves to that discipline, and we have to hope that will keep us humble, that even though we might think we're exalted, and even though reviewers might tell us we're mighty intelligent and mighty articulate, mm-hmm. that we know that we're just at our best, we're just reflecting very poorly the light of God, who created us and to whom we owe everything we have.
And I think it's also a strong witness to the importance of that anchor, which is the teaching of the church. It's the reason why it has survived for 2,000 years. And because they are not anchored to that, where Tertullian ended up In his later years, nobody knows the name of that. Nobody understands that teaching. It didn't last.
That's right. And in retrospect, it even seems kind of silly. You know, it was just this blip on the screen of religious history, because it really didn't have any staying power. It has the seeds of its own destruction. Because once you're saying that, well, anyone can sit in judgment of everyone else, well, then you're creating the conditions of possibility for infinite splitting of the church, because anytime anyone fails at anything, and we're all fallible, anytime anyone fails, they're going to be judged, and we're going to have a new church and a new church and a new church. This can happen, infinitely down through the ages. Well, Montanism did not have the staying power, and now when we look back at it, it just seems kind of crazy that he would have abandoned the Church of the Apostles for this kind of prophetic, pseudo-prophetic, really, religion that was just emerging on the scene.
How do we know, Mike, what teachings or writings of Tertullian we can trust, that we should read and embrace and take to prayer?
Well, there is a certain cutoff. I mean, we know that sometime probably in his 50s, late 40s at the earliest, is when he went into schism. But the writings of Tertullian that we can trust are the ones that are quoted in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. We can use that as a sure guide, because the Church is conferring a certain authority, at least on these texts that it's quoting. So we can look in the Catechism. You know, you look back in the index at the back of the Catechism, and it'll tell you the various works of Tertullian that it's quoting. And I think just about everything by Tertullian that's been translated into English is available online. There's a wonderful website put up by an Anglican scholar, Roger Peirce. It's called tertullian.org.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward over the next couple segments that we do, Mike, of talking and learning more about Origen and Eusebius as well.
Oh, yes. The others who dwell in the Shadowlands.
The Shadowlands. Oh, I like that. Okay. Well, I don't want to end up there. I don't want to go there.
Don't.
Okay.
Good.
Mike, thanks so much for being with us and breaking this open. We deeply appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.